This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We're the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, a new report out of the Justice Department finds that for-profit prisons are doing a crummy job keeping inmates safe and secure. We break down the problems with America's carceral state with author and activist James Kilgore.
And the U.S. war against the Islamic State isn't going quite as well as intelligence reports would lead you to believe. A congressional task force has found evidence of intel manipulation at the highest ranks of U.S. Central Command. We'll discuss further in a classified session.
And also, I can smell it from here. The garbage can is getting prepped for use. We examine all the bad takes of the week and throw someone in the trash at the end of the show.
I can't wait.
You're going to have to, bud.
All right, I'll wait a little bit, but only a little bit. First, though, before we get to tossing people in garbage cans, I've got a score to settle with liberals. And I know I'm not speaking for just myself here when I admit that I got into a lot of knockdown, drag-out wars online with people over the Democratic primary. This is could be taken to mean confessions of a Bernie bro, but it's more like the Bernie bro strikes back here. Because one of the fights that I seemed to always get myself into was over whether or not Hillary Clinton is actually a progressive.
Yeah, well, you were only getting into those fights because you're not a total idiot.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there are total idiots out there. Now, obviously, a lot of her supporters would say she's not a progressive, which is why they support her. There are a lot of neoliberals out there, a lot of moderate Democrats, a lot of disaffected Republicans who actually like Clinton's centrism. That's why they're supporting her. But then there are these actual people who made the case during the primary over and over and over again that the left is being way too hard on Hillary Clinton and that she is, in fact, a bold fighter for progressive values. Now, how many of them were just politicking for the candidate of their choice and how many of them actually believed it? I don't know. I mean, the Sanders and Clinton campaigns even battled it out for a few days between themselves over whether Clinton is a progressive. Remember when Bernie Sanders a few months ago said that Clinton is only progressive on some days, which, you know, to me is a pretty accurate statement, but it's one that the Clinton campaign refused to let stand. She wanted to make it known that she's a progressive all the time. Clinton herself responded to these charges like this.
Kind of a low blow when Senator Sanders said in response to a question, well, you know, maybe she's a progressive on, you know, some days.
Kind of a low blow. Seemed like an accurate statement to me.
Seemed like a low blow if, in fact, the truth is located in a low position and the blow was Senator Sanders striking the truth straight in the middle of the truth area.
That's exactly how I interpreted it.
Yeah.
In that truthy zone in the lower regions.
Yeah.
So Clinton goes on to prove her progressive bona fides. Is it bona fides or bona fides? I've heard people say it both ways.
I think if you're a pretentious Latin guy,
you go fetus?
Fetus.
Well,
go for that fetus.
Anyway, she went on to prove that she's a progressive by touting her fight for the children's health insurance program, her fight against Bush's move to privatize Social Security, which isn't really all that progressive as much as it's just like defending the status quo from right-wing extremism. She touted her support for gay rights, even though she was opposed to gay rights until just a few years ago, at least their right to get married. Anyway, the Sanders campaign pointed out obvious times when Clinton was not a progressive. It tweeted that you can be a moderate, you can be a progressive, but you cannot be a moderate and a progressive. And then the Sanders campaign went on to note that Clinton supported the Iraq War, that she initially supported both the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal and the Keystone XL pipeline, both things she's now come out against, and that she was currently raising millions of dollars on Wall Street with a super PAC. They brought up a number of other examples as well. And this Twitter fight between the Sanders campaign and the Clinton campaign over whether or not she's a progressive lasted a day or two. But it carried out for several months, both before it got into the full-scale brawl between the campaigns and after among supporters of both campaigns. There were headlines like this over at the Huffington Post that read, quote, Hillary Clinton is a progressive Democrat, despite what you may have heard. Here's what people would be saying about her if she wasn't running against Bernie Sanders.
Totally wrong.
Well, now she's not running against Bernie Sanders. She's running against Donald Trump. And I dare someone, especially those who are out there on the front lines making this case a few months ago, to say that Hillary Clinton is a progressive. I dare someone to say it right now. They can go look at Sam Sachs on Twitter and tweet me.
Or me. Please tweet at Sam Knight One.
You see, the Bernie bros and Bernie sisters were right all along. Clinton is a neoliberal with a neoconservative foreign policy. And that's fine. It's what most of the political elite in Washington subscribe to. It's what our past presidents have subscribed to. So it should be of no big surprise that this is the case. But it's not how she was sold to the electorate just 3 months ago. And all those people telling me that she was a progressive, going on TV, saying she was a progressive, writing endless columns saying that she was a progressive, and actually believing it, well, they should feel pretty stupid right now, because here's what their so-called progressive candidate and her campaign and surrogates have done since locking up the nomination. They've spent the last few weeks rehabilitating the images of Bush war criminals, the architects of the illegal Iraq war, and trying to bring these people into her coalition. Now, this is unfathomable. And it's not just short-term political expediency. She doesn't need to win neocons to beat Trump. Trump is imploding right now, folks. He's losing in Georgia. He's losing in Utah. These are reliably red states that if he can't win in those states, he's going to get blown out. So the Obama coalition is more than enough for Clinton to defeat Trump. And yet here she is, here her campaign is, bringing in neoconservatives, people who have long opposed and criticized even President Obama's hawkish policies as being too weak. She's bringing these people into the fold. Now, how is that progressive? Someone fight me right now on Twitter to defend this. How is this progressive? She's also fundraising with frackers now. Clinton attended a $50,000 per plate fundraiser in Aspen, Colorado last week, hosted by fracking magnate Sharif Souaki. The event raised $650,000 for her campaign. And as the International Business Times reported, Souaki amassed his fortune working for natural gas companies, including one he founded last year, Tellurian Investments. Subsidiary of Tellurian, Driftwood LNG filed for a license in June with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to construct a natural gas export facility in Louisiana. These are the people who are holding fundraisers that Hillary Clinton is gladly accepting invitations to. Remember that Huffington Post article I mentioned earlier, which boasts that Clinton actually is a progressive? Well, it lists climate change as one of her strong marks, noting that she has taken an increasingly tough stand against frackers, which is true if you're talking about a tough stand hitting them up for more and more money. That article, by the way, also applauded Clinton's support for increasing the minimum wage, even though she was cautious to support what actual progressives and what people fighting in the streets were actually proposing, which was a $15 an hour minimum wage. Remember, she spent the whole primary campaign saying that $12, that's what we should be aiming for, a $12 minimum wage. It also gave her praise for her positions on higher education, even though she refuses to accept the idea that access to college should be a right for all citizens. Instead, she wants to turn it into a welfare program. And let's also not forget this, and this was extremely surprising to me given the way her campaign acted during the primary. Consider who she picked as her running mate, Tim Kaine. We've ranted on this on the show before.
Yeah.
A white man. Not exactly the most intersectional dude you can pick as your running mate. By the way, Tim Kaine supports the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funding of abortion. And I don't know, I remember during the primary when the Clinton campaign mercilessly attacked Sanders, who opposes the Hyde Amendment, by the way, but he was attacked for not remembering to explicitly call for its repeal when he was putting out his platform, his campaign platform. So a few months after criticizing Sanders for not being explicit enough in his call to repeal Hyde, the Clinton campaign picks as their vice frickin' president a guy who supports the Hyde Amendment. Again, who wants to fight me on how that's progressive?
I'm guessing no one, because they were just straight up lying to you and the entire country to begin with when they were saying that Hillary Clinton was progressive.
Yeah.
Just wanted to toss that old...
I still believe that there were true believers out there who are just like really upset with this or something, but I haven't seen them come out and express it. That's all I'm saying. I haven't seen the articles on Slate and Salon saying I was duped by Clinton during the primary.
Yeah.
By the way, Tim Kaine also supported a trade promotion authority, giving the president the green light to finalize TPP without Congress being able to amend it before getting an up or down vote on approving it. So I don't know. This has been stewing in my mind here for a bit, and I wanted to rant on it a little bit. Again, clearly Clinton's better than Trump. This doesn't need to be said, although we're going to say it each time we criticize Clinton because people online are idiots. But she's not a good choice for progressives. She never was, even though she was billed that way. And now we're seeing that play out in this general election.
Just real quick right here, I wanted to read something that I'm looking at Yahoo News right now, which says that the Hillary Clinton camp this week formally launched a group called Republicans for Hillary, or it's actually called something stupider. It's called Together for America. But the only sentence you need from this, just quote it here. Their goal is to eventually build grassroots support among conservatives, an aide to the Hillary Clinton campaign.
That's real damn progressive, folks. Real damn progressive. Anyways, enough of that. It's making me sick. Let's do some news for the 99%.
It looked like this year was going to be the year, Sam, as states have increasingly embraced the decriminalization or outright full legalization of marijuana. Pressure has built on the Drug Enforcement Administration to change its scheduling of the substance. Currently, marijuana is a Schedule 1 narcotic under the Controlled Substances Act, meaning it's officially considered by the DEA to have little to no medicinal value, just like heroin and ecstasy. This prevents research from being done on medical pot, despite the fact that prohibition on weed for medical purposes has ended at the state level already in over half the country, 25 states plus Washington, D.C. So Democratic Party legislators here in Washington have gone hard on the DEA in recent months, calling on them to change their outlook. In the Democratic primary, for example, Bernie Sanders said that marijuana should be removed entirely from DEA scheduling, and other progressive lawmakers have pushed to reschedule it. Yeah, I like that. Shout out to
just give me the light.
Shout out to Peter Tosh. Anyway, in June, 8 senators, including Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley, wrote the DEA denouncing their rules, saying, quote, "The dissonance between state laws and the drug Schedule 1 status has wide-ranging implications for legitimate marijuana businesses, including access to banking services, the ability to deduct business expenses from taxes, and access for veterans."
That's right. It's not just, you know, affecting users and creating high incarceration rates, but lots of big business and businessmen are being armed here who want to involve them.
That too, but also importantly, it's a very important medicine. It's a very important painkiller to a lot of people, including veterans. So the letter continues. They said the conflict has significant consequences for preclinical, clinical, and epidemiologic research. And as such, they asked the DEA to reclassify marijuana, which is something that the DEA had been considering for months.
So are they going to do it?
So on Thursday, these senators and the entire country got their response to these senators' letter, and the DEA said no. It decided to keep marijuana on Schedule 1, which again means it's officially considered to be as dangerous as heroin. The decision was based in part on a Department of Health and Human Services study, which concluded, quote, that marijuana has a high potential for abuse, has no accepted medical use in the United States, and lacks an acceptable level of safety for use even under medical supervision.
Are these people living on a different planet? Like, I don't understand how you can come to that conclusion.
Yeah, especially
half the country has found that it has a medicinal value and allows for people to use it for medicinal purposes.
I mean, not just that, just compare it to alcohol. People are walking around every city in this country drunk, knocking each other out on a weekly basis.
Yeah, and can I just say, because we're about out of time here in this segment here, marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug next to heroin and ecstasy. A Schedule 2 drugs are drugs that are considered to have medicinal value, but can still be harmful. Cocaine is currently a Schedule 2 drug, which means our government currently regards cocaine as less dangerous drug than marijuana.
Really quick, despite the whole reefer madness, I just wanted to bring up how the federal government is already benefiting immensely from state level initiatives on medicinal marijuana. According to one study published in July in Health Affairs, it examined Medicare Part D data from 2010 to 2013 and found that patients have been increasingly using medical marijuana as a substitute for opioid painkillers and antidepressants, and that as a result of this alone, the federal government saved $165 million in 2013 on spending on drugs.
And that's damn good. Just a quick silver lining to this announcement from the DEA, they are going to open up more facilities to do research on marijuana. Currently, like only one college can do research on it.
So that is a very small
silver lining. More unanimous dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you, still in Washington, D.C.
The Justice Department Inspector General came out with a report on Thursday about the state of affairs in for-profit prisons. As you might have guessed, they aren't great.
Not good.
The investigation examining several types of problems, including lockdowns, inmate disciplinary actions, and possession of contraband, found that private prisons, quote, incurred more safety and security incidents per capita than comparable public sector facilities under the direct oversight of the Bureau of Prisons. The report also knocked the Bureau for not properly overseeing these for-profit facilities, noting that in recent years, disturbances in several federal contract prisons resulted in extensive property damage, bodily injury, and the death of a correctional officer. The IG called on the Bureau to assemble a working group to study this disparity in safety at public and private sector federal jails, and it called on BOP to improve oversight at for-profit prisons, including efforts to ensure that inmates are receiving basic medical services.
Joining us now to discuss corporate prisons is an expert on America's sprawling correctional state, James Kilgore. He's a community activist based in Urbana, Illinois, and the author of Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. Thanks for coming on, James.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you.
So this report from the Department of Justice Inspector General reviewing private prisons in the country, what were your thoughts on it?
I think it's fairly predictable that the incidence of violence and other issues within private prisons, the conditions in private prisons were worse than the average public sector prison that's under the control of the Bureau of Prisons. And it's been a fairly long-standing piece of knowledge that private prisons tend to be more deregulated than public prisons. They tend to cut more corners, and there tends to be more violence in those institutions.
So for someone who sort of is just now learning about this issue about mass incarceration in America, how would you describe the role of private prisons in the overall problem?
Well, private prisons are a fairly small part of the prison industrial complex. They hold about 8% of people who are incarcerated across the country, about 12% in the federal prison system. But there's a particularly sinister aspect to them. I think their fundamental purpose of making money by locking people up and making more money by locking more people up for long periods of time really grates on anyone with even a basic sense of social justice. So the fact that cutting corners in prison programs, for example, things like education or cutting corners in medical services or in food provision, for example, shows us that there's a fundamental incompatibility between the profit motive and running a prison.
I'm reading from this latest Department of Justice report, and it explains the background of private prisons, stating that the Federal Bureau of Prisons was operating at 20% over its rated capacity as of December 2015. And back when this started to become a problem, it says to help alleviate overcrowding and respond to congressional mandates in 1997, the Bureau of Prisons began contracting with privately operated institutions. So it appears that the problem here isn't created by private prisons. It's created by the fact that we have so much overcrowding, which has forced the Bureau of Prisons to rely on a lot of these private outfits.
Yes, of course, the fundamental question to ask is why do we have so many people in prison? So perhaps rather than outsourcing this to private providers, they might look more at ways to get people out of prison, to reduce mandatory minimum sentencing, to stop the war on drugs, and all of the other things that have led to this incredible wave of incarceration that's really swept across the country for the last 3.5 decades. So I think notions of overcrowding quite often are sometimes accounting manipulations as well, that the overcrowding may not be quite as severe as it is statistically portrayed, but it becomes an excuse to outsource or to build new prisons.
So this report was produced by the Department of Justice, which obviously operates on the federal level and is about the Bureau of Prisons, which again operates on the federal level. Do we see private prisons having the same role on the state and local level, though?
They're used a little more widely in the federal sector than in the state and certainly in local jails. However, it's very uneven. So you have states like New Mexico, for example, where more than 40% of the prison beds are under the control of private prison operators. But I think a special thing to make note of is the fact that in the federal system, we also have immigration detention centers, which are not under the Bureau of Prisons, but that's a separate sector related to ICE. And we have an incredible presence of private prisons in the immigration detention center. So they hold roughly 50% of the beds in the immigration detention center. And this is a market niche for private corporations as well as a growing sector. So although there's a move to decrease incarceration in many parts of the country, in terms of immigration detention, we're actually seeing an increase, particularly with a flood of asylum seekers and so forth. So it's really become the real key to profit for the private prisons has been harsher immigration policies, harsher immigration laws, more roundups and so forth. And in the prisons that were studied here, we find that in two of them, more than 40% of the people there were there for immigration-related offenses.
And of course, immigration and customs enforcement falls under the Department of Homeland Security umbrella, so it wouldn't be included in any DOJ report, let alone a Bureau of Prisons report. Just to go back to a little bit about what you were saying was driving this sort of outsized role for private prisons in immigration law enforcement, do you think it's primarily being driven by the flood of Central American migrants? And sort of analogous to how in 1997 BOP expanded use of contract prisons, they were just trying to fill a niche and something they could do with sort of, you know, minimal oversight.
Well, I mean, once again, it's a solution of convenience, but I think it's also the result of considerable, you know, lobbying and political positioning by these private prison corporations. They spend millions over the years lobbying state governments, lobbying the federal government in order to get contracts with these corrections entities. So it's not simply an accident that all of a sudden we find more and more private sector prisons operating in the immigration detention centers, but rather it's the result of a consistent political campaign as well as them operating in terms in the state legislatures and so forth, and at the federal level to press for harsher immigration laws, like these immigration laws we've seen in places like Arizona, SB 1070, in Alabama, in Mississippi, and so forth, which have greatly increased the number of people who are incarcerated for immigration-related offenses.
That gets to my next question, James, and you touched on it there. I'm wondering what the selling point is of these private prisons. We have this evidence that they are less safe, they're less secure than the government-run facilities. Also, it's not clear if they actually are run any cheaper, if they save governments any money. In fact, a 2012 study in Arizona reviewing Arizona's for-profit prisons find that the state was actually losing $3.5 million a year by relying on for-profit corporations to house inmates. They found that the rising costs were rising much faster under private prisons than they were under public facilities. So is all of this just the lobbying that you speak of that's created this demand for private prisons, or is there actually some sort of benefit that comes with turning to the private sector to house inmates?
Well, I've yet to see concrete evidence of the benefits. As you pointed out, the cost savings are pretty dubious. Arizona isn't the only state that's where evidence of it not saving money has surfaced. But I think it's really part of a much broader kind of privatization mantra, part of a kind of neoliberal paradigm, which somehow tries to convince people that things that are operated by the private sector are more effective than public sector delivery. And so I think people accept that within the corrections sector because it's part of the broader politics of the era. And so it's no different than what we see in many other sectors in the sense that there's an argument that says that the private sector is cheaper, that it's better managed. But when we scrutinize the provision of services, we find that that's not the case. Healthcare being one of the most obvious instances of this.
During the primary season between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, Sanders came out and made this claim that, you know, if he's elected president by the end of his term, he will make sure that the U.S. is no longer leading the world in prison population. A lot of people criticize his comments as not making any sense and that most prisoners are at state and local level. So Bernie Sanders wouldn't be able to do much to get rid of the hundreds of thousands of people out of prison that would be needed to, I guess, lower the U.S. from the number one spot in the world when it comes to incarceration. What are your thoughts on what Bernie Sanders said and the reaction to his comments, and just how far-fetched is it to work to make sure that the United States no longer leads the world in this grim statistic?
Well, the federal system only holds about 10% of the people who are incarcerated in this country. So even if they were to release all of those people, it would still only reduce the prison population by about 220,000. So no matter what happens at the federal level, that is within the Bureau of Prisons, it's a relatively small impact on the system as a whole. But having said that, I think the federal government does play a lead role in terms of the ideology that operates within criminal justice more broadly. So if we go back to the Reagan years and the war on drugs and the beginning of mandatory minimums, which were really sparked to some extent by the federal sentencing guidelines of 1984, we see that there is a much greater impact that the federal government has beyond that 10%. But it's certainly correct to say that no matter what the federal government does, if the state governments don't fundamentally change, we won't see a big shift. And so I think there was some grandstanding involved there. And also the notion, one of his proposals was that he would abolish federal contracts with private prison operators or even try to abolish them at the state level. Well, abolishing those private prison contracts isn't necessarily going to reduce the number of people who are incarcerated. It may shift them back into state institutions and make them more overcrowded. It may also provide the impetus for more tax revenue going to build more prisons and jails. So unless you get at some of the more fundamental issues besides simply getting rid of private prisons without offering alternatives to incarceration, you're not going to fundamentally change the number of people who are locked up or the nature of the conditions under which they're incarcerated.
I'm glad you brought up those fundamental issues because I wanted to ask you something more broadly, and I suspect I might already have an idea of what your answer would be, but there's been some criticism that the talk of prison reform and criminal justice reform has focused too much on nonviolent drug offenders, I think, because they're very politically easy to defend. They commit victimless crimes. Do you think that there's too much of a focus on nonviolent offenders? Do you think that the prison reform movement has to look more broadly at just the tough on crime mentality from everyone from, you know, guys who are arrested for smoking a joint to, say, for example,
robbery.
Yeah, exactly. An actual violent crime.
Absolutely. This is a systemic problem. And a lot of the reform efforts are looking at either quick fix solutions or easy path solutions. But when you actually look, for example, at the number of people who are in state prisons, where we have the vast majority of people, it's about 54% of the people are there for some kind of violence-related crime. So even if we got rid of all the nonviolent, the so-called nonviolent people in the system, it wouldn't still reduce us to the level of incarceration that we see in other industrialized countries. But there's a whole level of arbitrariness about what is considered a violent crime and what isn't, because our whole system is based on plea bargaining. So you may get caught with drugs and a gun, and your plea bargain may either drop the drug charge and convict you for the gun offense, or drop the gun offense and convict you for the drug offense. But it's the same case, but one of them is going to be considered violent, one of them isn't going to be considered violent. So there's a whole lot of arbitrary boundaries between violent and nonviolent. The other thing is, if we're really talking about looking at who are the people who are most likely to commit crimes again and so forth, it's not people who are in prison for long periods of time for violent crimes. They're some of the least likely people to actually commit crimes again. So it's really just trying to find a quick fix solution that the public will swallow, rather than, as you point out, addressing the fundamental punitive mentality that exists not only in the criminal justice system, but in the social welfare system more broadly. That is, it's the criminalization of poverty, the criminalization of poor people's daily survival activities that needs to be addressed, not really trying to find the easy way out of incarceration.
Well, the Democratic Party platform this year has called for shutting down private prisons. But as you just said, James, we could shut down all the private prisons, but that doesn't necessarily do anything about overcrowding, because we'll just dump them into publicly run institutions and still claim that dubious spot as world's greatest imprisoner. James Kilgore, author, activist, check out his book, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, James.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you. Still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
You're still Sam Sachs, and I'm still Sam Knight.
Yep. Same identities. We're the District Sentinel News Team, and you can read all of our reports over at www.districtsentinel.com.
Still,
District Sentinel. Now, without further ado, Mr. Secretary, please lead us into a classified session.
Need to get into classified session.
God, he's so good at that.
Yes.
He's so good at getting us into classified session.
Yeah, we couldn't do it without him. So it turns out that the Daily Beast, that neocon outlet that publishes heaps of garbage, actually got one right last year when it reported that higher-ups at U.S. Central Command were manipulating intelligence reports to make the U.S. war against the Islamic State appear to be more successful than it really is. Now, U.S. CENTCOM oversees operations in the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia, you know, all the places that we're currently bombing. And a report released on Thursday by a Congressional Republican task force confirmed that military leaders doctored intelligence analysis in order to paint a rosier picture of the war on the Islamic State. Now, this was something that the Daily Beast first reported last year. Now, these findings by this congressional task force are preliminary. They are also colored a bit by political motivations. This was a Republican task force. But we are going to get a fuller picture of what's going on at SecCom in the fall when the Department of Defense Inspector General is expected to release its report on the matter. But here's what was uncovered, at least by this task force. The intel manipulation appears at this point to have been the result of bad practices by senior CENTCOM leaders. The Republican task force said that they relied too heavily, these CENTCOM leaders relied too heavily on information, quote, provided by U.S. and coalition units directly engaged in countering ISIL, people who have a stake in reporting that they're doing a good job, that they're making progress against the Islamic State. The investigation stated that this was done specifically to offer a, quote, more positive view regarding the capabilities of Iraqi security forces and the progress of the fight against ISIL. And this was being done, by the way, in contradiction of, quote, vetted, serialized intelligence reporting on which analysts customarily rely. So the normal processes for creating these intelligence reports were being circumvented, overruled by higher-ups at CENTCOM who relied on other sources of information that made the fight against ISIS look rosier than it really is. The task force additionally shed light on a survey which had revealed that 40% of CENTCOM analysts reported, quote, problems with analytical integrity and CENTCOM processes. Upon analyzing the written responses to the survey, the task force found, quote, four separate comments alleging that intelligence was doctored or slow-walked to avoid conflicting with senior officials' testimony to Congress. In other words, when you get the generals and the top brass hauled up in front of Congress and they're questioned, hey, how's our fight against ISIL going? And they say, hey, we're making progress. They need the intelligence reports to reflect that as well. And there were people at CENTCOM making sure that happened. Again, we'll know more about how the intelligence was manipulated and why in a few months when this Inspector General report comes out. We'll have more information on that. Suffice to say, though, this story could bring back bad memories of the last time that intelligence was cooked in order to justify more war, back when the Bush administration did it with Iraq about a decade ago.
Well, there's a clear difference, I'd just like to say, between, you know, this controversy and that, which is this was based on complaints by 50 whistleblowers.
Yeah.
50 whistleblowers came out of the woodwork and spoke to the DOD Inspector General about this problem. I don't think there was anything similar we can describe about, you know, problems with the buildup to the Iraq war.
That's right. There wasn't. And by the way, intelligence manipulation aside, there's another way that the Pentagon is being cagey when it comes to revealing information about the Islamic State war. And that is, they're refusing to disclose just how many U.S. troops are actually fighting in this war. Although it's been more than 2 years since U.S. personnel were first deployed back to the region in the war against ISIL, the Defense Department only discloses the number of permanent troops in Iraq and Syria that are engaged in this war. That totals 3,825 U.S. soldiers in Iraq and 300 soldiers in Syria. Again, these are just the permanent stationed troops, permanently stationed troops. The numbers don't include temporary troops that are deployed on shorter missions in the region.
Yeah, permanent there being a relative term.
Yeah.
It's not wild to assume that U.S. troops are going to be in Iraq and Syria until the end of time as we know it.
Yes.
But yeah, I just wanted to point out that distinction.
This is a distinction created by the Defense Department, which probably doesn't mean indefinite, permanent thousands of years in the region. But look, they're only counting these so-called permanent troops. They're not counting the temporary troops who are still in harm's way conducting missions. And by not reporting those numbers, the Pentagon could be obscuring just how large the U.S. force size is in Iraq and just how quickly it's growing. An Army spokesman told reporters in March that, quote, there's been a decision made not to release that number, and said that he didn't have a reason for not releasing this number other than the fact that it was an order that he was under. A month later, a CENTCOM spokesman clarified, saying, quote, we do not release those numbers due to the fluid nature of their presence. Those numbers fluctuate on a daily basis. So then, Exactly how many U.S. soldiers are deployed in the fight against ISIL? That's the question. The official count is just over 4,000. Again, we mentioned that. But if you add unreported troops, there's a lot more. For example, we have 800 additional troops and personnel temporarily deployed to Iraq, plus another 100 U.S. troops that serve at the Office of Security Cooperation in Baghdad. On top of that, the administration is deploying about 400 more troops to Iraq soon. We've heard those announcements from President Obama in recent months. And the Pentagon could add an additional 422 troops at any time. Now, CENTCOM has reported that outside Iraq and Syria, there are between 700 and as many as a couple thousand U.S. soldiers assisting in the ISIL war effort. And on top of all of that, there are about 1,600 U.S. private defense contractors patrolling the region as well. So, although the Pentagon is only admitting a force size of about 4,000 soldiers, the actual number of American troops and contractors on the ground in Syria, in Iraq, and in surrounding countries fighting ISIL is likely double that number. A low estimate of about 8,000, and it could be as high as 10,000 soldiers right now fighting against the Islamic State. So it's a big difference from 4,000, one that you think the American people should know about and that the Pentagon should be transparent about. Now, before closing this classified session, speaking of ISIS, Donald Trump has found a way to get the media to stop talking about his incendiary Second Amendment comments that many perceived as a veiled threat against Hillary Clinton. He just went ahead and said something even more outrageous. Trump is now claiming that President Obama is the founder of ISIS.
In many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. Okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder.
Oh, man. Okay, look, maybe Trump was being hyperbolic there, just using that common Republican refrain about how Obama was too weak in Iraq and Syria, which allowed ISIS to rise up. And, you know, in that kind of roundabout way, he founded it. No, Trump didn't mean that at all. In fact, he later clarified his statements, asked if he really meant that Obama founded ISIS, like Obama is al-Baghdadi. Trump said, yes, he literally founded ISIS. I'm reading Trump's quote, I meant he's the founder of ISIS. I do. He was the most valuable player. I give him the most valuable player award. I give her too, by the way, Hillary Clinton. So he means it. Now, before listeners get all outraged by yet another demonstrably false thing that Trump said, just remember, he's got something brand new and demonstrably false lined up to say tomorrow.
But if he does want to walk back that ridiculous statement, he will probably say that he said at the beginning of that, in many respects, which is another version of many people say, you know, that's, I guess, one of the Trumpisms that he might use as a shield.
Nice job defending Trump over there.
Well, you know what?
Someone's got to. All right, that concludes our classified session. And now, since it's Friday, y'all, it's time to bring that stinking garbage can into the studio and toss someone into it. Oh, yeah. TGIF, also known as the day to take out the trash. Yep, we've got a full slate of garbage candidates for you who said or did something exceedingly awful this week and now will be shamed by being tossed in a stinking receptacle of hot trash. So here they are, your garbage candidates of the week. Garbage candidate number one, Senator Mark Kirk, the Republican never-Trumper, revealed this week who he intends to vote for, and it's not Trump, it's not Hillary Clinton either. Not Jill Stein, not Gary Johnson, nope.
Is it Evan Egg McMuffin?
It's not Egg McMuffin either. Senator Kirk said he's voting for Colin Powell.
What?
Nope, Colin Powell isn't running, so yeah, that's a bit stupid. But why Kirk might end up in the garbage can is the reason why he's supporting Colin Powell instead of Hillary Clinton. He said, quote, Hillary Clinton was for the Iran agreement, and I can't support someone who is for the Iran agreement. Well, Senator, I have some bad news for you. Guess who else supports the Iran agreement? Mr. Colin Powell. Powell called it a pretty good deal last fall, adding that it enacts, quote, remarkable changes that are, quote, very, very important. So, I have a different candidate you can write in, Senator Kirk, that I know is opposed to the Iran deal like yourself. It's the garbage can. Maybe you'll end up spending some time getting to know it.
Yeah, Kirk also said before that he was going to vote for David Petraeus.
Who's also not running.
He's also not running. So maybe we'll throw him in the garbage can twice. In fact, because write-in votes in Illinois don't count unless the candidate has registered with the state, we might even need to throw Kirk in the garbage can three times, because there is nothing sadder than a far-right never-Trumper trying to make a fake stand, unless that fake stand is based on fake moral outrage, which will get you nowhere. So I think Kirk is a very good candidate for the garbage can.
Good.
Let's move on to garbage candidate number two.
Which is Betsy McCaughey.
I didn't even know how to pronounce her last name there. I got to be honest with you, but she's trash. Why don't you? Or she could be trash.
Look, she was just named to Trump's Economic Advisory Council. You know, the one that initially included all white men, including five different Steves.
Is she going to have to change her name to Steve?
She might. This council was, of course, primarily made up of billionaires, hedge fund managers, bankers. Well, Betsy is on board now. And in case you're wondering who she is and why she qualifies for Trump's economic team, even though she's not a white guy named Steve, it's because she's the one who made up the death panels rumor a few years ago. In 2009, during the healthcare debate, McCaughey made the rounds on conservative media, repeating the claims that the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare would create, quote, death panels to ration care for sick and elderly patients. This claim of death panels gained so much prominence that it became a regularly used talking point by Republican politicians. And eventually, PolitiFact awarded the death panel charge the Lie of the Year honors. Well, she's now bringing her enormous lies to the lie factory that is the Trump campaign. And as a result, maybe she'll get to lie down in a garbage can.
Yeah, that would... I haven't thought about death panels till now, so that's a good shout. But let's move on to garbage candidate number three. The Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, back in March, Gawker reporter Andy Cush, which is an awesome name, by the way, a very dank name. Andy Cush published a report alleging that the sheriff's office was up to no good, including using quasi-official resources to spy on journalists and political opponents. The report details how one deputy admits on tape to assisting the sheriff with racially profiling and conducting elaborate revenge plans on his behalf. Well, in the follow-up to the reporting, Cush has made several Freedom of Information Act requests to the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, and so far he's been completely stonewalled. He reports this week that most of the documents handed over by the office have not been relevant to his reporting, including the latest document dump, which was 73 pages, of black ink, 73 pages of redaction. Literally, Cush received from the sheriff's department 73 pages of emails sent from the sheriff's office, second in command, presumably referring to an outspoken critic of the office, and all the emails are redacted, obscured by FOIA censors, FOIA officers. If you really want to look to see what that actually looks like, you can check out Cush's latest article over at Gawker, but really it just looks like white pieces of paper with giant black blocks on them, stuff you'd probably just throw in the garbage can along with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office itself.
Indeed. And we've got time for one more garbage candidate. I think you've got someone here.
Yeah, Corey Lewandowski.
Our good friend
Corey, a former Trump staffer, sued the campaign's former director in North Carolina this week, accusing his ex-boss of pointing a loaded gun at him in February. And you're going to have to wait for a second for Corey to get involved here. So it happened in Earl Phillips' Jeep, according to the complaint. It was filed by a man named Vincent Bordini. Philip was driving and Vincent was in the passenger seat. Philip produced a pistol, put his right index finger on the trigger, and drove the barrel into Vincent's kneecap. Once the initial shock wore off, Vincent said, "What the F expletive deleted, are you doing? Philip put the gun away as if nothing had happened. Philip drove on and didn't talk about it again. Petrified, Vincent kept his mouth shut. Vincent then told the regional director from Western North Carolina, who said that Philip had pointed a gun at him too. So this was not an isolated incident. Now this brings us back to Corey, our good friend Corey, the former national campaign manager who is still a paid advisor to Trump while simultaneously working as a paid CNN contributor. Vincent Bordini went to Lewandowski and told him about the incident, and Lewandowski did nothing, which allowed Earl Philip, the insane gun brandisher, to rise to a job on Trump's National Diversity Coalition. You can't make it up.
No.
Now, Philip resigned on Thursday after Bordini filed the lawsuit, but for not firing Philip and for allowing that maniac to get promoted to the Trump National Diversity Coalition, which surprisingly itself hasn't collapsed under the weight of its own inherent self-contradiction, Corey Lewandowski, garbage man, you could go in the garbage can.
All right,
can.
Let me just say that Corey Lewandowski, I think we're going to have multiple chances to throw him in a garbage can over the next 6 months.
Sure.
Mark Kirk, he just made so many dumb mistakes.
Yeah.
Voting for someone who's not running and then using the reason he's voting for that person is completely flawed as well. I think I'd kind of like to throw him in the trash can.
I think I'd like to as well. Without reading the quote, Kirk has also said a bunch of racist stuff, and he's like pretending that he has some big problem with Donald Trump.
So we'll look at his overall record for this week and say that Senator Mark Kirk, you are going in the garbage can. Good luck winning your re-election bid with trash all over you.
Especially that baby wipe.
Ew, gross. Folks, that's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. Be sure to check out all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by going to our website, www.districtsentinel.com. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for next week's shows. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay right here in D.C. so you don't have to be.